Our guest is the mathematical biologist Kit Yates, who's come up with an elegant equation for the value of mathematics in everyday life, from embryo formation to eggshell patterning, even deciding which is the best seat on a train. In his book, The Maths of Life and Death, Kit explains how maths underpins everything we do. Indeed, how it's sometimes a matter of life or death. Presenting seven mathematical rules outlined in seven chapters, he explores life-changing events where the application or misapplication of maths has played a crucial role. Kit says the book is for everyone who's ever been made to feel that maths is too hard or that you can't appreciate its everyday beauty without reading equations or knowing algebra. With a PhD in mathematics from Oxford, Kit Yates is a senior lecturer in the Department of Mathematical Sciences and co-director of the Centre for Mathematical Biology at the University of Bath. He is with us from his home in the UK, so it's pretty late. Hello, Kit. How are you?
Hey, Catherine. I'm all right. I'm a bit tired, but I'm doing fine.
Oh, sorry about that. I often think, hey, if you've managed to write a book, you've obviously put in some quite late nights already, so sorry for one more.
No, that's fine. Yeah, I feel part of the gig economy myself, working a job to write a book and my daytime job. So yeah, late nights.
What is mathematics? We describe it many ways. How do you describe it?
I think mathematics is many things to many people, but I think it's everywhere. I think it's in its deepest sense, I think it's pattern. I think people think that they gave up doing maths a long time ago, but for me, I think if you tap your foot in time to a piece of music, then you're hearing mathematics. I think if you sing in the shower and you hear your voice reverberating and it sounds nicer, it's because of some cool mathematics going on. If you see a fractal branch in a pattern in a tree or a snowflake, then you're seeing mathematics. And even when you're doing sport, if you curl a ball into a net, or if you catch a ball on its parabolic trajectory, then you're doing math. So, yeah, I think it's much more than what people expect it is, and I think it's everywhere around us.
It's a pattern. Could you speak to its infallibility? Because we talk about mathematical rules. We rely on mathematics done correctly to deliver an utterly reliable result. If it's done correctly, is maths infallible?
It's a really good question. So maths works really differently to the other sciences in that we use inductive. We build up our proofs from axioms. So we deduce things from these fundamental building blocks, and that's how mathematical proof works. So in maths, we have theorems which have been proved to be true. In science, it works the other way, in that we have theories, and those theories have just not been proved to be false yet. So yeah, in pure mathematics, at least, everything that people have proved is consistent with those original building blocks. But actually, I'm an applied mathematician, so the way I work is much more like a science. So we put hypotheses forward, mathematical models which we think describe the world, and then we try to test them with real experimental data. And often we find that we got it slightly wrong and we need to tweak our models. One good example that's in the book is in the UK, we've been vaccinating teenage girls against the HPV, human papillomavirus, for a while. But recently, with more new data, we've rerun the mathematical models and we found that actually it's going to be more cost effective and more fair to vaccinate boys as well as girls. So it's a sort of nice example of where maths that we thought was originally correct has been turned on its head by new evidence and new data, and we've been able to make policy decision based on that. And so, yeah, the HPV vaccine comes out for boys this month in the UK.
For people intimidated by mathematics, beyond perhaps the basic arithmetic, I know for me personally, out of sheer laziness, middle high school, when the algebra and the memorising of equations came into things, that's when I began to just drift off, having had quite a strong basis in arithmetic and still have a strong basis in mental arithmetic. So is it a language, and is that part of the mystery? Those of us who bailed at a certain point feel like the rest of you who are advanced can speak a language to describe things that we can't speak.
I think to some extent that's true. And what I'm not advocating in the book is that everyone should go out and do degree level mathematics. But what I think that the message I'm trying to push in the book is that some mathematical concepts, perhaps not the details, but the mathematical concepts are accessible to everyone. I think in the book, I try to explain these concepts using stories and analogies and metaphors. And those are the really important things. So yes, I think at high level, it is like learning a different language. But at the same time, I don't think you need to know that language in order to appreciate the benefits that mathematics can give us. And I think throughout the book, I try to provide these tips and tricks and hints and hacks which people can use to get an advantage in their everyday lives in our increasingly quantitative society.
What then is mathematical biology?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think when I tell people I'm a mathematical biologist, I think usually I get a sort of blank stare or a polite nod of the head. I think people can't really see how a subject which they perceive as sort of being messy and real world, like biology, can have anything to do with this other subject in maths, which they perceive as being very pure and abstract and very much devolved from the real world. But actually, maths really is all about describing the real world. And so for me, as a mathematical biologist, I take a biological system that I'm interested in that could be a swarm of locusts, and I'm interested in how to stop them swarming, or it could be the way that cells migrate in an embryo, and I'm interested in stopping embryonic disease forming. And then I build a model, which is just a representation of that system. And then I try to use experimental data. So we work closely with experimentalists to parameterize that model to make it more accurate. And then we make predictions, and we try to make predictions about situations where we can't access experimentally, perhaps because the experiment's too difficult, or maybe it's unethical to do that experiment. So we can use mathematics to further the cause of science by doing mathematical biology.
Let's talk about one of the areas that you are very passionate about in your research, which is the embryo patterns. What's the work done there?
So I'm interested in developmental diseases. There's a group of cells in an early embryo which are called neural crest cells, and they go on to contribute to all sorts of different tissues in the body, so parts of the eye, the heart, the gut. And if you get a problem with these neural crest cells migrating across the embryo, they go from the back close to the neural tube, which goes on to become the spine eventually, or the spinal cord. They go all over the different parts of the body. And if you get a problem with the migration of these cells, then it gives rise to a whole family of diseases called neurocrestopathies. So these range from, at the very mild end, things like piebaldism, which is a pigmentation pattern problem. You get depigmented areas of skin, all the way through to things like Hirschsprung's disease, which is a failure of the colonization of the gut with neuroblasts, which effectively enervate the gut and allow you to push food through the gut. So you get these chronic obstructions in the gut because you can't properly push the food through. So we're trying to understand what happens when these cells stop migrating properly to get from one place in the embryo to the other, and how potentially we can correct that. I look in particular at melanoblasts or melanocytes, which are these pigment cells which produce the pigment in our hair and skin, and try to look at how they migrate around the embryo. And we use those as a proxy for all the other more complicated cell types.
So what are you doing in the modelling? Do you need sophisticated computer equipment? What do you do to test your models?
We do a bit of both. We do some what we call analytical mathematics, where we write down some equations and we try to make predictions based just purely on equations, doing stuff on pen and paper. But actually, to get the real nitty-gritty of the biology down, we really need to use more sophisticated computational models. So we use things called individual-based models, where we model each cell as an individual entity, and we can give them certain rules about how they can move based on real experimental data. And we basically watch as they try to migrate from one end of a growing embryo to the other and see if they can get to the right place in the right time. And if they can, then that means that things are going right. But if they can't, then that we can look at how to tweak the model to try to understand how we might change the biology to correct for these embryonic diseases.
I think you've likened it to a game of Tetris, trying to fill up grids.
It really is a bit like that. Yeah, we use these things called on-lattice models, where you basically divide space up into a grid, and you give these cells, you give them rules to move around, and they can jump from one lattice site to a neighboring lattice site, bumping into each other or responding to chemical signals. And yeah, it's very much like a game of Tetris, trying to fill up this grid within a certain time limit. It's surprising similarity.
One can see all the potential of this in health, and we mentioned earlier the locust plagues, but in especially in our interconnected world now, we the speed at which any kind of disease against we don't have against which we don't have protection, or virus against which we don't have protection, the potential is obviously horrendous. And again, is this work that biological mathematicians are doing, and if so, how? What is it that you're doing to model and possibly intervene in outbreaks like that?
Yeah, it's one of the big areas of mathematical biology is looking at is mathematical epidemiology. In fact, it's one of the most important tools in the fight against infectious disease. There's been a lot of mathematicians who've been honoured in, you know, birthday honours lists for the amazing work that they've been doing on this front. We tend to build models which are some variation of a mathematical model called the SIR model. So we basically break the population down into three groups: susceptible people who have not yet had the disease, infective people who have the disease and can pass it on, and what's euphemistically referred to as the removed category. So that's people who've either recovered or who've died and no longer pass on the disease. So yeah, we can build these mathematical models where people pass from one stage to the other. And it turns out there's a really important number that comes out of this mathematical model. It's called R0 or R0. And effectively characterizes how quickly the disease spreads compared to how quickly people recover. And effectively, if this number is bigger than one, it means that one susceptible person in a population will pass their disease, will pass that disease on to at least one more person. So the disease can grow and grow exponentially. But if we can reduce it to being less than one, then we can stop that person passing it on from at least passing it on to at least one other person, and stop them passing it on to the next person. We can cause the disease to die out. And the things we can do, and it sort of points to useful strategies for doing this. One of the most important ones is getting people vaccinated. This can dramatically reduce the effective reproduction number, this R0, in a population. It can stop diseases breaking out. But there are other practical things that we can do. Like, it's interesting you're talking about this gig economy, because actually it causes people to often go into work when they're ill because they haven't been given enough sick days in one of the jobs that they're working. And when people do that, then they tend to pass the disease on to co-workers or other people that they see during their job. And that actually is much worse for the economy than if that person had just taken the day off and stayed at home and not passed the disease on. It's always tempting to send our kids to school when they're sick because it means we have to take the day off work. But actually, it's much better for society as a whole if we just keep them at home and stop them from passing on the disease. So there's lots of practical advice that can be given by looking at these relatively simple mathematical models. And it's fair to say that maths was at the forefront of the battle against the recent Ebola outbreak from 2014.
Well, look at other areas where you want people to be informed. Again, we may not all be able to speak the language or write the language of mathematics, but understanding its principles and concepts can affect us from everything from being charged with a crime to trying to navigate an election campaign as a citizen and a voter. But I do want to talk about one thing that in some ways feels like it's dominated the application of mathematics in recent years, and that is exponential behaviour, because of course we're talking about computing power here. What do you write in your book about thinking exponentially, not just thinking one multiplication step ahead, but to the power of? And how is this affecting our lives, whether or not we get the maths?
Yeah, it's a really good point. Actually, the whole of the first chapter is dedicated to exponential behaviour and thinking exponentially. I think back in the day, our predecessors, our ancestors, would have expected to live in the same place as their parents and to do the same jobs as their parents or the same sorts of jobs, and things wouldn't have changed very much for them day to day, I think, or generation to generation even. And I think nowadays that's all changed, and I think that jobs that our kids are going to be doing in the future may not even have been thought of yet. The rate of pace of change is exponential. It's growing incredibly quickly, and I think that we need to be prepared for that. I think when the Human Genome Project, this is a really classic example, when the Human Genome Project was started, people scoffed at the scale of this project, sequencing all 3 billion base pairs of the human genome with the technology they had. They said they'd never be able to do it, let alone in the short time scale they predicted. But actually, sequencing technology improved exponentially, and nowadays you can sequence thousands of genomes in a single day. So things are really, the pace of increase is itself in technology is increasing, we need to be aware of that to some extent, to be aware that things are becoming obsolete as well in the other direction, as new technology replaces them. So it's a really important thing to be aware of.
And its impact in computing and what computers can do.
And
I'm not sure that
absolutely.
there's a theory at some point we're going to reach a plateau in that. I don't know if there is a mathematical rationale for that.
Yeah, there's this idea of what's called Moore's Law,
which
is that the computing power doubles roughly every 18 months. There's actually no mathematical rationale for that, but it seems to be holding true. And actually, now that we've sort of reached the limit of how fast processors are, but we're just basically keeping Moore's Law going by putting more of them in each computer. So we're parallelizing computing.
These
so
are
that
the
we can
supercomputers, supercomputer stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Putting more of these cores in each computer so that we can do huge computations. The other place where exponential behavior sort of affects us, perhaps without us even knowing it, is in our perception of time. There's one theory, and again, this is not mathematically sound, this is just a theory, is that that time accelerates, or at least our perception of time accelerates exponentially. So I don't know if you remember as a kid, the time between Christmases seems to take forever. I know certainly my son, I can't wait for his next birthday. He's only four. But the part of the reason why that might be, and why birthdays seem to come around at an increasing rate nowadays for us older people, for us adults, is that we perceive a period of time as a proportion of the time we've already lived through. So for my son, who's four, the wait between birthdays is a quarter of his life, which seems massive. But for me, I'm 34, and actually a year is roughly 3% of my life. So it seems to slip by faster. So this rule that we would perceive a period of time as a proportion of time we'd already lived through dictates that our perception of time increases exponentially. So yeah, it's something to be aware of.
Kit Yates is my guest. We're talking about The Maths of Life and Death, his book, The Application of Maths to All of Our Lives and Underpinning Many Areas of Our Lives. Let's look at some of the real-life situations and people that you write of, 27 minutes past 10. Let's look at the law of mathematics as it affects actually the legal system. And this was a classic case of where expert advice. This brings together a different branch of science in some ways, which is probably to do with how much weight we put on expert opinion and the psychological responses to expert opinion. But what happened in this court case where faulty mathematical evidence resulted in an unjust conviction?
Yeah, this is the case of Sally Clark, who was found guilty at the time of murdering two of her infant sons at age 6 and 11 weeks. In large part, that guilty verdict was reached because of the testimony of an expert witness. The testimony, it turned out, was mathematically incorrect for a number of reasons. The most plain reason is something called independence of events. So the expert witness was interested in what the probability of these two deaths not being murders were, but being natural deaths by sudden infant death syndrome. So no cause that could be isolated, but this thing called SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. And effectively, the prosecution wanted to show that two SIDS deaths in this family would be so unlikely that the other option, that Sally Clark had murdered her two children, was the only possible option. So the expert witness found this figure for the rate of a single SIDS death in a family, and it was 1 in 8,000 families, so it's quite unlikely. And then to work out the probability of two of these deaths in a family, multiplied 1 in 8,000 by itself, squared that number, to get a figure of 1 in 73 million, which was the headline figure in this trial. And it swayed jurors in their opinion of how likely it was that she'd killed her children, given that this other alternative they were offered was seemingly so unlikely. But actually, the expert witness had made a mistake, because actually these two events are not independent. The probability of having a second child die of SIDS is higher once you've had a child die of SIDS in the first place, because there are risk factors associated with it, like smoking or sharing a bed with your child, or even genetics. There's been a number of genes found to be associated with SIDS, and clearly two children from the same parents are going to share a lot of the same genes. So by multiplying this figure by itself, the expert witness had made the probability of the alternative explanation for these two deaths seem incredibly unlikely to the jury, which left them really, especially the way the prosecution presented the argument, with the only conclusion could be that she'd murdered them, and so she was convicted. And actually, the first appeal that they went through, the conviction was upheld. But the second appeal, fortunately, her conviction was overturned. But Sally never really recovered from this, and unfortunately, she died of alcohol poisoning a few years after she was released. It's a tragic, terrible story, and someone lost their life effectively because people misunderstood mathematics.
There's another example that I'm really interested in. This dates back to the 1930s, and it's pollsters who had estimated that Republican presidential candidate in the US election would beat Theodore Roosevelt. That was a case, again, not the maths was wrong, but the methodology was wrong, the sampling was wrong.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So the Literary Digest was the magazine which carried out this poll, and they carried out basically the biggest poll that anyone had ever done up until that point. They sampled 10 million voters in the US out of an electorate at the time of 40 million. So they sampled a quarter of the possible electorate. So they thought they were going to get really fantastic results. And actually, since 1916, they'd predicted the presidential winner every time ahead of the election. But this time they got something wrong in their polling, and they were subject to something called sampling bias. So the way that they polled people was by looking at telephone registers and registers of people who owned cars. But unfortunately, that meant that they massively underrepresented poorer demographics in the population and massively overrepresented richer demographics and more literate demographics who were likely to respond to their survey. So these people also tended to be correlated with people who voted Republican. So they massively predicted that this Republican candidate would win by a landslide. In fact, when the election results came out, because they'd sampled so badly, even though they'd sampled a load of people, it turned out that Roosevelt, who was the incumbent, actually won by the biggest election margin victory since 1820. So a real mistake.
So some of those principles we're talking about, reliability and validity, these are statistical measures, aren't they? And above all else, your margin of error, which comes back to whether or not your sample is good enough. I'm really curious, because pollsters did very well for a period of time more recently in getting pretty close to or predicting election outcomes, and then they've had a horror story lately. And is this all about the difficulty of getting a representative sample, because you can't reach people the way, you can't reach everybody the way you used to be able to?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think also, though, it's partly about the way people are responding to these polls. I think that people, certainly in the Trump election in 2016, I think there's a case to be made that people are actually embarrassed about admitting that they voted or were going to vote for Donald Trump. I think there's another aspect of the pollsters being so confident that Hillary would win that actually it gave them maybe a false sense of security, and maybe the Democrats didn't turn out as much as they would have done if they were genuinely worried about Trump being elected. And the Republicans were perhaps galvanized by this this underdog story and went out and voted in numbers. But I think there's probably a combination of both of those factors. But it's getting more and more difficult to get correct answers out of people and to sample people accurately. Yeah.
The power of algorithms in our lives, they are all pervasive whether or not we know it. And your conclusion is their potential is unlimited, but again, it comes back to applying them in the right circumstances. The maths won't be wrong, its application or what it's being applied to might be. Can you explain?
Yeah, I think that's right. So there's two aspects to it. I think people view algorithms as these sort of independent, unbiased machines. So people were worried that Google's trending section was being artificially tampered with by their trending team, injecting left-wing stories and removing right-wing trends that were happening naturally. So Google basically took out their trending team and replaced it with an algorithm. Facebook took out their trending team and replaced it with an algorithm. But within minutes of that happening, a fake news story from the right wing was trending on Facebook. I think people think that algorithms are somehow unbiased, but actually, of course, they're coded by a human being. So it's not that the algorithms are doing things incorrectly, but it's that they're doing what their human creators, who have their own set of biases, have told them to do. I think we place reliance on our algorithms, and usually it's the code for these algorithms is correct, but we need to remember that they're as biased as the people that code them up in the first place.
There's one very simple calculation that you do at the start of the book that's both delightful. I think we should come back always to what's happening in the garden, and also teaches a principle that can be applied to all sorts of situations. So what did you do with your son in the garden when you wanted to know how many snails might be there?
Yeah, so we go out in the garden quite a lot, and he loves creepy crawlies, slugs and snails, spiders and everything. But he asked me, he said, Daddy, how many snails are there in the garden? And I honestly didn't know. So I sat down and thought how we could figure this out. So I knew of this technique called capture recapture. So the idea is that we went out and we caught some snails, or found some snails. They're not too difficult to catch. And we marked up those snails with a little cross using a permanent pen on their back, so not to harm them. And then we put them back in the garden, and we waited a week for them to hopefully disperse around in the garden. And then we went out and we recaptured another snail population. And using this technique called capture recapture, you can calculate by looking at the proportion of marked snails in the second sample that you find, you can calculate what the total number of snails should be in the garden, because that marked proportion in the sample that you capture should be the same as the proportion of the first sample that you took to the total number of snails in the garden. So you can use this to count snails, but you can also use it in more serious contexts. People have used it to calculate, for example, the number of war dead in a war zone, or to calculate the number of drug addicts in the United States, or if you're into fisheries and you want to know how many fish there are in a lake, then you do one sample, you put them back, once you've marked them, you do another sample, and you can calculate approximately the number of fish in a lake. So it's a really useful technique, and ecologists have been using it for years. But super simple mathematics, but it's something you can do at home for fun with your kids if that's what you're into.
Apart from there being fewer snails on the first recapture because it was raining and they were all chomping on your lettuce leaves.
Sure.
Apart from an exception like that, why does capture recapture work? What's the basic mathematical equation that it represents?
Yeah, so it's just this idea that you are you need the sample to be representative of the population.
Yeah.
So to some degree, you need to hope that those snails that you've put back don't just all crawl under the nearest rock and that you find exactly the same snails again. You need to hope that those snails have dispersed evenly throughout the garden again. In the same way that when you put the fish back in the lake, you assume you're not catching exactly the same ones. You assume you're catching a representative sample and that somehow the overlap between the two populations that you've captured can tell you something about the proportion of the fish or snails that you caught in the first sample, and then that you can scale that up to calculate the total population of fish or snails.
With a margin of error of X number of scales. Snails.
Yes.
Or scales.
There's definitely
if it's
a
fish.
Margin of error. Scales if it's fish. There's definitely a margin of error there. I wouldn't place any big bets on it.
Wonderful fun, Kit. Thank you. Kit Yates, The Maths of Life and Death is published by Quercus.